This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
It's not enough to stop putting fossil emissions into the atmosphere. Somehow we have to reduce the levels of carbon dioxide, currently running around 410 parts per million. When we are finally ready to save ourselves from climate change, Peter Kellerman may have part of the solution. The answer lies in an unlikely place, the Sultanate of Oman. The country is south of Saudi Arabia and is the eastern neighbor of Yemen. Dr. Kellerman has been there many times over the years as part of the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University. Peter leads an international group of scientists studying a rare and beneficial rock formation that can gulp down CO2 and hold it. Dr. Peter Kellerman is a professor of geochemistry at Columbia University in New York and chair of Earth and Environmental Sciences from Oman. Peter Kellerman, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thank you very much.
Why go to Oman? Why not find these rocks in other places?
Well, these rocks are in other places, but the world's largest outcrop of these rocks from the Earth's interior is here in Oman. And in addition, of course, the climate is very arid and there's very little vegetation, so we can see the rocks very well. And finally, some of the carbonate deposits that form when the air interacts with these rocks would be dissolved and sort of pushed underground, if you like, in British Columbia or along the U.S. West Coast, where we have lots of cold rainwater and snow. But here in Oman, they stick around on the surface where we can observe them.
I always assumed the inner Earth somehow communicated with the outer Earth. I mean, volcanoes release molten rock from below, parts of the seabed we know fall back down. How is it possible there can be a layer that has never really come in contact with our atmosphere?
Well, that's a great question. But the process of subduction that returns rocks from the Earth's surface into the convecting Earth's interior is pretty slow geologically, and there are, on the way down, fluids are released that carry a lot of the volatiles, oxygen and carbon and such, back up into a fairly restricted volume of the mantle above subduction zones. And so the great part of the convecting mantle that, for example, feeds the mid-ocean ridge volcanoes, you have kind of a one-way transfer. Lava's coming out, but nothing's going in.
And what are the rocks that you're interested in, Oman? What do they look like, and how did they get there?
Well, what do they look like? They're kind of rusty red when you see them on the surface, because they have quite a bit of iron in them, and when that interacts with the air, that iron is oxidized and makes a kind of rust color on the surface. When you break them open, if they're not very reacted with the atmosphere, they're kind of nice green, translucent color. And then when they've reacted with the atmosphere and oxidized a little bit, they're sort of black. How did they get there? The oceanic crust offshore of Arabia about 100 million years ago, rather than being subducted beneath the continent, as is happening, for example, in southern British Columbia, those rocks were hot and buoyant, and they were thrust up onto the Arabian continental margin. So there's a big block of oceanic crust and what we call the mantle, the Earth's interior, oceanic upper mantle, thrust onto the Arabian continent. It goes for about 350 kilometers along the north coast of Oman.
Could you please explain to us the process of how these rocks can absorb generous amounts of carbon dioxide?
Yeah, so the main mineral composing these rocks from the mantle is olivine. Some of you may know it by the gemstone named peridot. It's a birthstone, I think, for October or August or something. And that gives the rock the name peridotite. So when peridotite is exposed on the surface, it reacts with the water to form serpentine minerals. It reacts with oxygen to form iron oxide minerals. And it reacts with CO2 to form magnesium carbonates, calcium carbonates, basically limestone, and you could call it marble. So in the rocks we're drilling right now, every single magnesium atom has made friends with the CO2, and the silicon that was in the olivine is just present as SiO2, free quartz.
And what happens to that CO2? Can the rocks hold it for long?
The rocks can hold it for thousands of years, basically forever on a human time scale.
What are the visual signs that I saw in a video that Columbia released that carbon's already being grabbed by the rocks in Oman?
That's right. So We see two kinds of carbonate deposits, magnesium carbonate and calcium carbonate solid deposits. One are travertines that form on the surface, great big flat plateaus of calcium carbonate with little rim pools. If any of your listeners have been to Mammoth Hot Springs in Yellowstone or the geysers in Iceland, you've seen these. So those surficial deposits are pretty extensive in Oman. And then in the subsurface, the carbonate minerals that form fill cracks and make veins that are eventually exposed by erosion, so we can study those on the surface as well.
Usually, Dr. Kellerman, we think of geological processes like weathering taking thousands of years, if not much longer. Can these rocks act in any meaningful time frame?
Well, they're sucking down about 100,000 tons of CO2 a year now, which is indeed quite small compared with the human output of CO2, which is something like 40 billion tons a year. But there are experimental studies that show that the natural process here in Oman can be accelerated by a factor of about 1 million. And you can potentially achieve rates of 1 billion tons a year by emulating the natural process, but exposing more of the rock to near surface waters.
So that would be, say, about 1/40th of our current production?
1 billion tons a year per cubic kilometer of rock. I don't think we should aspire to take the whole world's CO2 output in this way. It's one of many things that we can do, each one of which in parallel could amount to some kind of significant offset of our emissions.
Now, are we sure that we could capture more carbon than the emissions required for the technology to speed up the process?
Oh, yeah, but that's part of the challenge. So what we're studying here in Oman is a natural process, doesn't require any input of energy or cost at all. And so what we'd like to do is understand that spontaneous natural process and come up with engineered methods that emulate that natural process as closely as possible in order to have the minimum amount of energy input and the minimum cost.
Now, I found in my research a document saying that in 2012, a group was seeking funding to do more drilling into the rock, to do more research. Did that come about?
Well, yes. I mean, we are here in Oman working on the Oman Drilling Project. It's sponsored by the International Continental Drilling Program and many other funding agencies from all around the world, NASA and the National Science Foundation in the U.S., the European Science Foundation, the Swiss Science Foundation, German Science Foundation, and the Japanese Marine Science and Technology Center. So there are 40 principal investigators. There's right now 133 people signed up to participate from 8 different countries. And they have a variety of different interests, ranging from the formation of the oceanic crust at the mid-ocean spreading ridges, to interaction of hot seawater with the crust near the ridges, to the thrusting event that pushed that stuff up onto the Arabian continental platform and the chemical transfer that occurred at that time. And then weathering, you could say, so the present-day uptake of CO2 and water and oxygen by interaction with the atmosphere. And finally, there's a group of people who are particularly interested in the subsurface microbial ecosystem in these rocks, because the disequilibrium between rocks from the mantle and the atmosphere provides a source of energy that is the bottom of the food chain for these chemosynthetic ecosystems that exist in the subsurface here.
So you're saying there is life deep in the earth that has never come in contact with the atmosphere?
Only through these groundwaters and so on circulating through the rocks. I mean, the rest of life on the Earth has at the base of the food chain photosynthesis, but in the deep subsurface, the base of the food chain is so-called chemosynthesis. There are microbes that eat rocks, you could say.
So Oman's a pretty hot place. Do those temperatures assist or hinder the carbon absorption process?
They certainly assist the carbon absorption process. The mean annual temperature here is 30 degrees centigrade. And that there is a temperature relationship, that the hotter it is, up to about 180 degrees centigrade, the faster the reactions go. So I'm sure that things are happening a little bit faster here in Oman. The other thing that may be pretty helpful in Oman is evaporation, so that waters near the surface are evaporating within the rocks and depositing their all the things that are dissolved in them, including carbonate minerals. So that probably enhances the weathering process.
Now, you mentioned that it's possible we could speed up this process up to a million times. What do we have to do that?
Well, the best thing to do, well, there's a couple things. If we had a source of purified CO2 via, for example, capture of carbon dioxide from smokestacks, then you could raise the partial pressure of carbon dioxide in the subsurface, and that increases the rate by a factor of about 1,000. And you can access hot parts. As your listeners probably know, the Earth gets hotter as you go down, and so the temperature is much higher a few kilometers below the surface. So we can access those warmer rocks, and that also can enhance the rate by a factor of about 1,000.
And Oman produces a lot of oil, and I gather it burns oil for all its electricity needs and air conditioning and all that. Could this process help Oman go for a carbon-neutral economy, or even better, if that is one of the sources of carbon dioxide?
Well, that was under discussion a few years ago. The main oil company here is called Petroleum Development Oman, and for a while they were talking to us because they were considering having as a goal to be carbon-neutral as a company. But they changed their minds about that about 2010. And right now in Oman, there's some caution about this because some people feel that there's reputational damage associated with taking out the garbage for the world. And they would point to countries that take electronic waste and the damage to the reputation that those companies have suffered. And they would say, maybe this isn't a good thing for Oman to do. So right now, in the Oman drilling program, we're just studying the natural process. We're not doing any experiments on injection of purified CO2 or anything like that. And the Omanis, it's their country, it's their decision, and maybe someday in the future they'll do some experiments or maybe even try to do this on an industrial scale. But for now, they're not ready to do that.
Would we call this geoengineering or not?
Yeah. Well, you can call it geoengineering. It certainly is geoengineering. Geoengineering, in some circles, is a pejorative term associated with, for example, with putting lots of reflective particles in the stratosphere and reflecting sunlight back into space, which is potentially a fairly dangerous thing to do. I think that the process of speeding up taking CO2 and making it into solid carbonate minerals is comparatively very benign, but it certainly involves engineering, and it's certainly geological. So it's geoengineering.
Have you had any interest from other national governments?
I wouldn't really characterize it as active interest. Now, of course, the government of Iceland is very much involved with a similar project where they're at one of the power plants. They actually produce pure CO2 as a byproduct from their geothermal power plants. And they just finished a small pilot study where they reinjected that CO2 in a slightly different kind of rock. Lava derived from the Earth's interior. And they had very promising results. So basically, all the CO2 they injected disappeared along the flow path of the fluids and presumably was mineralized, formed solid carbonate minerals. So now they're going to scale up. And I'm not familiar with the details, but they're certainly planning to get rid of all their CO2 waste stream in a big project to convert that into carbonate minerals.
Have you looked at any models or projections of what it would cost and what it would take to really get this going and get as much carbon as we could out of the atmosphere and into those rocks that you're studying?
Yeah. There's a couple of different things we can talk about. Using purified CO2, of course, there's a cost up front for the process of capturing carbon dioxide from smokestack gas or wherever. But if that were available to us, I think that we could achieve solid storage for something in the neighborhood of $50 a ton of CO2. We're a little bit more ambitious. We don't think that that's going to happen at scale anytime soon, because if carbon dioxide capture and storage were to take off, it's so much better understood how to inject that CO2 into subsurface pore space, into depleted oil reservoirs or sub-deep saline aquifers. So that's almost surely the first direction that a large-scale carbon dioxide and storage regime would go. So we're more interested at the moment in direct carbon capture from air, where you would circulate seawater through these rocks, remove the carbon dioxide from that water, and then return the carbon-depleted water to the sea surface, where it would draw down carbon dioxide from the air. And in that context, we think that this might be the least expensive way to directly remove CO2 from the atmosphere.
Would there be any risk to nature if that route was taken?
Not really, no. I mean, you could turn it off any time, really. And taking 100 parts per million CO2 out of the air is a prodigious project. So long before you reduce CO2 to some kind of dangerous level, you would stop. So energy use globally continues to increase by about 3% per year. It's almost all supplied by using fossil fuels of one kind or another. So emissions are also continuing to increase by about 3% per year. Even though, I mean, per capita emissions are falling in Europe and the United States, largely due to the big shift from coal to gas. But in the developing world, that hasn't happened. And so CO2 emissions continue to go up, and atmospheric CO2 concentrations continue to go up despite the focus on this. So most of us, including the IPCC, think that the atmosphere will probably go too high, that the levels of CO2 in the atmosphere might exceed 500 or even 600 ppm in this century. And it could be that that's too much. I mean, no one's totally sure about the economic consequences of this, but it could be too much for a sustainable future, in which case we'll have to find a way to remove CO2 from the air. And that's more difficult than capturing CO2 from a smokestack, because the air is, you know, 200 times more dilute than smokestack gas. But it's possible, and it's not so terribly expensive. And so it's in that context that we're considering how we might use these rocks to directly capture CO2 from air.
It must be a little bit surreal to see that we have a problem right now. I mean, it's obvious in the changes in the weather and in so many things that scientists can measure, and yet we're not ready to do anything about it. So you're working for a possible future.
Well, that's right. You know, the thing is, I think in the United States, a majority of people are persuaded that human emissions are causing climate change. What they're not sure about is how much they should spend to fix it. And that's a pretty complicated question, because you add the uncertainty of exactly how the climate will change to the uncertainty of what sort of crops might be affected, what the damage is due to sea level rise, and so on. And you have quite an uncertain scenario. And so people aren't quite sure how much it's worth to try and mitigate that. So that's understandable, but I expect it will change over time. So let's make the analogy to building sewers. London didn't have any sewers until the second half of the 19th century. And then they spent about 2% of GDP over 10 years to dig up all the major streets in the world's largest city and install sewers. So no one's looking in the rearview mirror and saying, wow, that was a waste of money. So when people think that putting CO2 in the air is like throwing poop in the street, then the cost for CO2 management will seem quite reasonable. Until then, I don't know if we're going to really attack this problem at full scale.
Until it floods our streets. You know, one of the wonders of science, and I was reminded about this while researching your work, and that's the difference between the thickness of the Earth's crust under the continents and under the oceans. I thought it was sort of all one uniform layer, but it's not. Why did that happen? Why is it thinner under the oceans?
Oh, that's a great question. So the oceanic crust is formed along a chain of volcanoes that spans the world at the mid-ocean ridges. So anybody these days can go online and get a map of the Earth's surface, including below the sea, and you'll see these shallow regions going around approximately in the center of all the ocean basins. So those, it's like a steel factory. Those volcanic ridges are producing new oceanic crust, like ingots of steel flowing away from the foundry. And that material, when it first forms, is hot and buoyant, but as it cools, it becomes denser than the underlying mantle. And it falls back into the earth. And it falls back along the subduction zones, so that it never sticks around very long. The oldest oceanic crust on the surface, other than things that get pushed up on the continents, the oldest oceanic crust on the surface of the Earth is about 180 million years old, and after that it vanishes. The continental crust is buoyant with respect to the underlying mantle, and so that's why parts of the continental crust have been with us for 4 billion years. So continental crust kind of accumulates on the surface. Oceanic crust gets dense and sinks back in. And over those billions of years, the continental crust has gotten quite thick and extensive. But the oceanic crust has pretty much maintained its original thickness that forms at the ridges.
Well, I'm fairly old and fairly educated and did not know that until this very moment, so I sure appreciate that.
Okay, well, look, I mean, Google, have your readers, you Google seafloor spreading. That's a good place to start. But it's, you know, you're not alone. And the concept that I've just explained to you, first of all, is about as close as science ever comes to just facts, not theory. Secondly, it wasn't discovered until when people speculated about continental drift, but seafloor spreading and the meaning of subduction zones wasn't apparent until after I was born in 1956. And it was still not accepted in wide parts of the geological community when I entered high school in the late 60s. So it's an amazingly young scientific theory, but I don't think there's anybody anymore who's educated in geoscience who would doubt it.
I'm just reading other new science about the interaction of the Earth's crust and the mantle, and it stimulates in me this wonder that we spend so much money exploring other planets, and we still have so much to discover about our own planet. Your thoughts?
Isn't that interesting? Why is it that dinosaurs and planets stimulate so much interest, but the bottom of the ocean and the Earth's interior are less popular topics for,
Research investment?
Well, research investment, we do okay. But yeah, it's just, especially as budgets tighten all over the developed world, we are looking at a funding situation in which societal relevance and the excitement of specific topics on television drive a lot of funding decisions. And so in that context, it is a little painful that people don't find the bottom of the ocean more interesting.
Now, I did find your work published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in 2008, titled In Situ Carbonation of Peridotite for CO2 Storage. Have you made some progress in the years since then?
Oh, yeah. So we have a paper in Annual Reviews of Earth and Planetary Sciences that you can find. And then we've had a number of specialist articles in all kinds of scientific journals right up until this year. I'm not going to list them all, but these days, everybody has access to Google Scholar, and if you just type my name in there, you'll find them.
Is there anything else that you would like to tell us as we wrap up here?
Just that I guess everybody should realize that scientists are out here doing our best to come up with a whole palette of possible solutions to the greenhouse gas problem, and no one really knows which ones would ultimately emerge as the most successful. And so all we can hope is that these different projects will be allowed to go forward in parallel and mature and be ready when people need them or want them.
And I hope that's soon. From his fieldwork in Oman, our guest is Dr. Peter Kellerman from the University of Columbia. You can find out more using links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. I'll lead you to some articles and videos about all this. Dr. Kellerman, it's been an honor to have you on Radio EcoShock.
Well, thanks a lot. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.